Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe, as I know so many of you are. That cut opening tonight's show is called Tharsis by Son of the Widow. Well, I want to thank Jane for sending in this quote from Isaac Asimov. Seems appropriate for the show. I could certainly relate. Isaac said, and I quote, "Anti-intellectualism has been a constant thread winding its way through our political and cultural life, nurtured by the false notion that democracy means that my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge," unquote. So true, isn't it? I was thinking about trickle-down economics, denial of climate change, the insane belief that women can't get pregnant if they're really raped, our country allowing itself to get lied into a bogus war, and on and on and on. Not to mention the fact that there was a time on this planet when women were not dominated and exploited by men. Maybe that's what passes for normal today, but that was not how it maybe was quite a long time ago. And we're going to see to it that that changes. We have a new normal in mind, and it's not a normal that involves anti-intellectualism or exploitation of anyone, for that matter. Well, I hope you've perhaps caught up with all the shows you might have missed recently, because I haven't had a lot of time in the last month to send out email reminders. So please click the follow button on my show page to make sure you don't miss any wonderful guests. We've been talking about the goddess that was in that Paleolithic cave in the movie or docudrama Cave of Forgotten Dreams, yoga goddesses, the American goddess, connecting with spirits on the other side, dream temples of Egypt, and the goddess Hera, and also famous women in their use of sacred hallucinogens. And I have some really big breaking news you might not have heard. I am ecstatic to announce I have coming on the show June 5th, the famous Noam Chomsky. Yes, indeed, I'm very excited about that. Starhawk is also coming on in July to discuss her upcoming film, The Fifth Sacred Thing. And tonight we have two great guests. I think all my guests are great because they really are. First up, calling in at the top of the hour. In fact, she's on the line right now, calling from Portugal, where it is 2 a.m. in the morning. The dear lady Anne Fidel, discussing Mary Magdalene and alternative pilgrimage and ritual creativity at Catholic shrines in France. As many of you know, Mary Magdalene is an important female figure of Christianity that has been transformed into a repentant prostitute, and she is very important in goddess spirituality as well and in Christian groups advocating for equal rights. We'll be talking about her sacred sites, new rituals, and belief of practitioners. Lots of good stuff. Mary Magdalene is always a favorite topic here. Followed by the man who dared speak truth to power, Matthew Fox, who was excommunicated by the Vatican because he wouldn't toe the party line, much like the nuns they're having problems with these days. He's an Episcopal priest now. He used to be a Catholic priest. He's the author of over a dozen books. Matthew Fox returns to the show to discuss the controversy surrounding the former pope, the Vatican and the CIA joining forces to combat liberation theology in Latin America. We'll also talk about the new pope and if the outlook for change in the church. Of course, we'll be discussing the Vatican's position coming down on the nuns, who won't toe the party line, and Matthew's new book on Hildegard von Bingen. Well, the chat room is open, so if you'd like to post any questions for our guests, please do. But first, just a bit of housekeeping and a word from Joe Carson in Dancing with Gaia.
The psychic state is the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet. It's called the chthonic mind, the mind of the earth. Our ancestors understood that the animal and divine were all connected. They were together. That there wasn't a separation. That's what we are trying to return to, is that sense that our animal nature is divine. It doesn't get in the way of the divine. It gets us closer to it.
What's your idea of being fully alive as a human being? Because that's what's really spiritual. Write it down. Start writing your own Bible if you want.
Sex is sacred. And by that, I just mean sweaty, fun, happy sex.
That was some of the sounds and some of the dialogue from the trailer Dancing with Gaia, a feature documentary about Earth energy, sacred sexuality, and the return of the goddess as Gaia. It's a sincere film that goes deep into the connections between these important topics. The DVD comes packaged with a 45-page mini-book that expands on the material in the film, and you can get it at dancingwithgaia.com. It really is a must for any library and something to definitely consider if you're looking for a gift for someone. I want to remind listeners, especially if you're new to the show, because we have so many listeners that join us every month, I do public service announcements here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, as well as paid commercials to help defray the cost of airtime, because we do not have a sponsor, which we are looking for. And if you can contribute to helping me pay for airtime, that would be fantastic. Remember, Gaia teaches us what we care for and nurture thrives, and what we neglect withers. You can make a contribution to the cost of the airtime by going to my webpage at KarenTate.com. When you're there, check out the Goddess Store page. Scroll down to the bottom and see the PayPal buttons. Please make a donation of any amount because it's all welcome and small contributions add up. And while you're there, check out the free stuff you'll find throughout my website, meditations, articles, classes, talks on my YouTube channel. And with all that out of the way, let me say hello and introduce my first guest, Anna Fidel, by way of her bio. She has accomplished a lot. She's an Italian anthropologist whose research focuses on the intersections of gender and religion with a peculiar emphasis on corporality. Corporal reality, sexuality, and ritual creativity. She grew up in Bolzano, a small town in the Italian Alps. She's done research in Italy, Spain, France, and Portugal, and also in the San Francisco Bay Area when she was a visiting scholar at the Anthropology Department of Stanford University in 2010. She's currently a visiting fellow at the Robert Schuman Center for Advanced Studies of the European University Institute in Florence. Her dissertation has recently been published as part of the Oxford Series in Ritual Studies under the title Looking for Mary Magdalene, Alternative Pilgrimage and Ritual Creativity at Catholic Shrines in France, published by Oxford University Press, which is sort of the focus of our chat tonight. Also, Gender and Power in Contemporary Spirituality, Ethnographic Approaches. The volume Anna co-edited with Kim Nidby has just been published as part of the Routledge Studies in Religion series. Her master thesis has been published as a Spanish book entitled El Camino de Mary Magdalene. The text explores the figure of Saint Mary Magdalene from the beginning of Christianity until the publication of the Da Vinci Code in 2003, with particular attention paid to contemporary interpretations of Mary Magdalene and its relationship with the feminist spirituality movement. She's done a lot more stuff, but I think that will tell you that she is certainly qualified to be talking to us tonight, and she comes to us as an expert on the subject. And so welcome to the show, Anna.
Thank you, Karen.
And thank you especially for calling from Portugal and being up in the middle of the night, 2 a.m. You're a trooper. We appreciate it.
I drank a lot of coffee.
Well, Anna, let me start with asking you, why do you think Mary Magdalene was cast as a prostitute to begin with? Was it a mistake? Was it intentional? Was it misogyny? And when was her name finally quietly cleared?
Well, it is difficult to say why it happened, as many of you probably know already. It happened because a pope in the 6th century decided that Mary Magdalene was one and the same with other figures called Mary in the Gospels. This is a major problem because there are many Marys in the Gospels, and in the Gospels contain very little information about Mary Magdalene, this Pope found that three different figures could be collapsed into one and identified as Mary Magdalene. And the two figures that were later recognized not to be Mary Magdalene were described as repentant women. So they were not even described as prostitutes. We cannot be sure that they were prostitutes. So I think that we cannot really know why this happened. But what is interesting is how the figure of Mary Magdalene has been used as the representative of sinful women. She was also the patron saint of prostitutes, and also Magdalene houses were still active until the past century, until the 20th century. And there women were kept who had illegitimate children, and these were Catholic houses.
So Magdalene houses. I might be wrong about this, but I seem to recall maybe something about that happening in Ireland. And please correct me if I'm wrong. That's perfectly okay, because I don't want to mislead, my listeners with bad information. But wasn't there the story that, in some of these houses, women were really mistreated by the church?
Well, there is this famous movie, Magdalene Sisters, that traces the story of one of these Magdalene houses. I must confess that I haven't done much research into Magdalene houses. For sure, these were places where these women had a possibility of having a place, because otherwise in the society they were... they were refused by their families and by the Catholic society they were living in. So, of course, the situation in these houses was not easy, because they didn't have a lot of money, and also these women were treated as sinners, so probably they were not treated very, very well. In my case, my interest in these Magdalene houses derives from the fact that one of the pilgrims that I interviewed, and that was part of the pilgrimage groups I accompanied, had been born into a Magdalene house and felt that she had a special connection to Mary Magdalene because she had been born in one of these houses.
Okay. Well, now some of my listeners have already sent in some questions, and so let me get those out of the way first, if that's okay with you. I know you're going to talk about the differences between Mary Magdalene, pilgrims or pagans in the United States versus Southern Europe. And I wonder if this question, maybe is one of those distinguishing beliefs that separates the two. But I wonder if in your research you believe, like some, some practitioners out there, some devotees of Mary Magdalene, that she was a pagan priestess, perhaps, or married to Jesus. I know there was a book out, I think Lynn Pinkett, if I remember her last name properly, she even went so far as to say Mary Magdalene and Jesus might have been practicing the Isis-Osiris mysteries. And, let's just get that out of the way first. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as an anthropologist, I'm interested in what people believe and how they relate to Mary Magdalene. And there is little historical evidence about this theories, because as we know, in the Gospels there is little information about Mary Magdalene, at least in the canonical Gospels. We don't even know how old she was, and whether she was married or not. I am for me, what was interesting was to discover what the pilgrims believed. And for them, Mary Magdalene definitely was a priestess of the goddess and a woman who was particularly in touch with the goddess and with the earthy mysteries and also with the sacred sexuality. And in this sense, this figure helped them to get in touch with their own femaleness and also to find a way to make peace with their Catholic past, because many of the pilgrims I accompanied came from traditionally Catholic countries in Spain and like Spain and Italy, and they had been deeply wounded by experiences within the Catholic Church. And but at the same time, they still felt attracted by Christian figures and rituals. And so through Mary Magdalene, they could find a sort of, a figure that could build a bridge between goddess spirituality and Christianity.
Okay, yeah, I'm one of those recovering Catholics. why don't we start with you telling me how you became interested in Mary Magdalene to begin with?
Yes, well, I have always felt attracted by female figures that have ambiguous contradictory characteristics. And Mary Magdalene had been described as a sinner, but also as a saint, as we have seen before. And she had been described as a prostitute, but also as the first person who sees Jesus after his resurrection. And so this captured my interest. And when I started my research in 2002, the Da Vinci Code had not been published yet. But there existed already lots of books and theories about the importance of Mary Magdalene and her special relationship with Jesus. And, for instance, Christian theologians referred to Mary Magdalene as the first apostle and used her example to argue in favor of women's rights to become free. And there were also authors related to contemporary spirituality who described Mary Magdalene, as we have seen, as a priestess of the goddess. And when I discovered that there were also spiritual groups making pilgrimages to sacred sites related to Mary Magdalene, I felt that I had found the topic for my dissertation. And but it was very difficult to convince, in fact, my professors at the university that this was a good topic for a dissertation. And for my master thesis, I focused on the different theories that have been elaborated about Saint Mary Magdalene from the beginnings of Christianity until the present day. And what mainly interested me was the fact that Christian authors always tried to find a man that could be associated with the Magdalene, because she was the only important female figure in the Gospel that had not been described as the wife, sister, or daughter of a male figure.
So and, it was almost as if a woman couldn't stand alone. She had to be attached to a male figure.
Yes, exactly. In the Bible, normally when a woman is mentioned, immediately it is also mentioned that she is either the sister or the wife or the daughter of a man that appears also in the Gospels. So in the case of Mary Magdalene, this does not happen. She is described as Maria Magdalene, and it is not even clear what this Magdalene means. So this was something that attracted my interest, because this woman was in some way out of control. She wasn't under the authority of a man. And so this is why, personally, I don't like so much the theories that describe Mary Magdalene as the wife of Jesus, because, again, they bring her back under the authority of a man. So in the case of the pilgrims I accompanied, for instance, they prefer to believe that she was the lover of Jesus, but that they had a very open and friendly relationship, not that they were married.
Yeah, they want her to keep her autonomy, and I can most definitely understand that, and of course this is speculation, but maybe that's that, you know, for those of us who are so quick to see the misogyny of the church, maybe right there that's a reason for marginalizing her, because, you know, after all, the church doesn't do well with autonomous women. I mean, look how, I mean, they tolerate Mary, the mother of Jesus, as long as she's, you know, benign and, you know, she's not a threat and, you know, she's a good girl. But, you know, Mary Magdalene, I guess we think was a little bit different. So maybe she was, her role model was more of a threat, I guess we should say.
Yes, it is certainly true that the church has always tried to control the dangers related to this figure of Mary Magdalene, that was very important because she was the first woman who saw the resurrected Christ, and this was a clear message that for Jesus women were important.
And so, do you recall when it was when the church finally apologized and came out and said they made a mistake and she wasn't a prostitute?
Well, I think that the most important year is 1969, when there was the reform of the book that I don't know how it's called in English, but it is the book that describes the lives of the saints, and there they corrected, they did no longer describe Mary Magdalene as a repentant prostitute, but just as the woman that followed Jesus almost from the beginning of his teachings, and that was present during the crucifixion, and that saw him when he was resurrected. So it was in 1969.
Okay.
As far as I know, there has never been an official apology. Just there was this declaration.
Okay, and. What I'm thinking of may have been that. I thought it was much later, but I could be absolutely wrong. So tell us about the peculiarities of these pilgrimages to the Catholic shrines of Mary Magdalene. How many of these pilgrimages did you take, and, you know, what were your observations?
Yes, just to go back to your question, you probably believe that it was later, because even if the church officially declared that, most of the clergy did not know about these changes, and actually even today in the churches I attend, at least, many priests are not aware of that and keep describing Mary Magdalene as a repentant prostitute. So there has been a change, but this has not filtered through to the priests who are saying the Mass every day. I mean, some of them may know about it, but not all of them, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So the church didn't go out of their way to send out a press release. It was kind of quietly
that.
Changed.
So
go ahead and tell us about the pilgrimages.
Yes. Well, the main places visited during these pilgrimages are in southern France, not far from Marseille. And according to a Christian legend, after the crucifixion, Mary Magdalene arrived on a boat to what is today the Mediterranean coast of France. And she arrived on this boat together with other Christians, and such as Saint Lazarus and Saint Martha, and also two other Marys. And so this is why the village where they arrived, according to the legend, is now called the Les Saintes Maries de la Mer, the Holy Marys of the Sea. And she soon retired to live in a cave in the mountain of the Saint Baume. And after her death, she was buried in the church of Saint-Maximin, and where her relics are still on display today. And these three places that I have just described, Les Saint-Marie de la Mer, where the boat arrived, the Saint-Baume, where there is the cave, and Saint-Maximin, where there are the relics, are the most important places visited by the pilgrims. And I accompanied pilgrimage groups from Spain, Italy, the United States, and the United Kingdom. And I found that even if they came from different countries and their tour leaders followed different spiritual paths, they had many things in common. First of all, as you have said before, they all criticized the church for having transformed Magdalene into a repentant prostitute in order to downplay her importance. They also accused the church because in their eyes, the church had transformed the power places related to the Magdalene, like this cave, into churches, and therefore into spaces monopolized by Christians. And the pilgrims claimed their right to celebrate their own rituals in these places and to venerate there the sacred feminine. Because inside the cave where Mary Magdalene is believed to have lived, a church has been constructed. And so the pilgrims, when they entered the cave and saw this, they became very angry and really felt that this cave had been appropriated by the church.
And so tell us a little bit about the cave. I've never actually seen pictures. Is it just a chapel on the inside that we're talking about, or is it, a church that's, built alongside the mountain where the cave is? Describe it a little bit.
Inside there is a chapel, but outside on the rocks, built into the reef, actually, there is a church, and so from the outside you don't even know that there is a cave. You see just this church, and then you enter and you actually discover that it is not a typical church, but it is a cave.
So do you have to go through the church to enter the cave now?
Yes, exactly. And also there is a spring inside the cave, and you cannot access it because it has the access has been denied. So this was very frustrating for the pilgrims.
I would imagine. I've led sacred tours, and that would be hugely disappointing, because we always like to gather our sacred water and bring it back home for our altars.
Yeah.
So that was one of the similarities between the pilgrims from different destinations. What are some of the other things that have cropped up as beliefs or practices of the pilgrims?
Well, in general, the pilgrims believe that Mary Magdalene could help them to get in touch with their female side. This was true for women, but also for men. And she appeared as a healer, specialized particularly in helping pilgrims to come to terms with the wounds related to their sexuality. I call these wounds sexual wounds in the book. And these were wounds especially related to sexual abuse, but also to miscarriage, abortion, or surgery on reproductive organs. And it seems that because of her own story, Mary Magdalene had been also wounded because she had been labeled as a prostitute. She was particularly useful in healing wounds related to sexuality. And another thing that I found was that Mary Magdalene was particularly related to menstruation and to menstrual blood. For the pilgrims, Mary Magdalene was in this sense opposed to the white and immaculate Virgin Mary that was born without blood nor sin and seemed to have no physical body. Magdalene, on the contrary, represented a woman of flesh and blood and could help women to find a more positive relationship with their own bodies and with their menstrual blood. And in fact, inside the cave, some pilgrims offered their menstrual blood to Mother Earth as a sort of ritual inversion of the Eucharist, where, as we know, Jesus' blood is offered to the Godfather in the sky. In this case, the female blood was offered to Mother Earth, that is below. And this, I think, were the most important issues related to the pilgrimage.
So now you consider this sort of a new form of pilgrimage, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And why would you say it's a new form of pilgrimage?
Well, because in classical pilgrimages, at least pilgrimages related to Christianity, an important element is the suffering of the pilgrim. Through the suffering, through walking on their knees or through walking during many days, the pilgrims in some way make up for their sins, and also they attain spiritual elevation. In this case, the pilgrims traveled in their cars, and yes, they had to climb up to the cave, but this was not a big effort. So,
right.
An important element is that the physical element is not so important. The physical suffering is not so important. The pilgrims did not feel. Please tell me.
I was thinking about, I remember looking at a picture of pilgrims, I believe it might have been in southern France, at a more typical church, that you saw hundreds of pilgrims crawling up these marble steps, and you know that had to be difficult, you know, after two or three or four or five. And but again, you know, it was all about it was all about the suffering. But isn't that typical though? I mean, I think one of the problems I had with the church was, you know, it wasn't life affirming, it wasn't joyous and uplifting. When you went to church, you saw Jesus suffering on the cross. You know, it's as if the whole message that's sent with the symbols is, embrace your suffering, you know, expect suffering rather than expect joy, expect a good life, you know, just kind of grin and bear it and keep your mouth shut, you know. I don't know, that's sort of the message that I feel like I got anyway, and I don't know, it's just bringing this all back for me as, you know, we're talking about that.
Yeah, well, I think that, yeah, there is a part that that is certainly true about that, but I think that as an anthropologist, we should first speak to pilgrims who are doing that and see how they interpret what they are doing. Because in some way, for instance, this is just an idea that pops up now, the suffering they experience can help them to come to terms with their own suffering. And so it is as if they manifest this suffering through doing this. I mean, we may not agree about this technique of dealing with suffering, but this is the way they choose. So what you say, the pilgrims I studied would actually totally agree with you, and for them the pilgrimage was a celebration, and they were singing and dancing during their tours and enjoying themselves. But I think that, the Christian way of doing a pilgrimage is can also be interesting, and there is, for instance, a fascinating book about the Camino de Santiago by Nancy Frey called Pilgrim Stories, where she tells the stories of these pilgrims and how much they enjoy the walking through nature, and that actually what should be something related to suffering and to pain turns out to be something cathartic. So I think it's a bit more complicated, but sure, you can also see it like this.
Yeah, no, I understand. It varies with the pilgrim. So were there challenges for you writing a dissertation about goddess spirituality in these Catholic countries of like Italy and Spain?
Yes, there definitely were. In fact, one of the main difficulties that I encountered was the general criticism among my colleagues towards contemporary spirituality. At the beginning, it was difficult to convince them that Mary Magdalene pilgrimages would be an interesting topic for a thesis. And when in 2002 I started talking with my colleagues about theories describing Mary Magdalene as the wife of Jesus or as a sacred prostitute, they looked at me as if I was crazy. And it was difficult to convince them that it would be a good topic for a thesis. And many of them thought that I was interested in a very marginal phenomenon that would not have any visibility in terms of mainstream culture. And so I was very lucky, because in 2003, 1 year later, the Da Vinci Code became a worldwide bestseller, as we all know. And my colleagues had to change their mind, because then Brown's book brought Mary Magdalene to the center of the world's interest, and suddenly everybody was interested in my research, and I could actually publish my master thesis.
And so here Anna was on the cutting edge, and it was your thesis advisors who weren't, didn't have the pulse of the mainstream world. Good for you, Anna. So what were the main differences you found between pagans in the United States and in Southern Europe?
Well, the main difference I found was that the men and women I encountered in Southern Europe during my research felt not at ease with the term pagan. Having grown up in Catholic families, they felt that the word pagan was too much negatively charged, and they didn't dare to use it. The same happened with the word witch, and sometimes also with the word magic. So they prefer to speak about goddess spirituality and about the priestesses of the goddess rather than witches.
Yeah.
And it was something that was also very different, was that it was very difficult to have them speak about their experience at the beginning when they didn't know whether they could trust me or not. In 2010, I lived for some months in Palo Alto, and I participated in their yearly pagan studies conference and also in the Pantheacon, and I could not believe how easy it was to talk with American pagans about their rituals and their beliefs and their healing experiences. It was totally different from what I had known in Southern Europe, because in the United States, pagans have formed established groups, and they have been recognized as a religion and have their own rights. And the things were and still are very different in mainland Europe, and especially in Southern Europe. Those practicing goddess spirituality are often very protective about their spiritual activities, because they are used to being constantly criticized and even stigmatized in their Catholic environment. Some
right.
of the groups recently told me that they have been under, their phones have been under control, because they were believed to be a sect, and it is really a difficult situation. So before sharing with me their experiences, they first had to see that I was respecting them and that I would not label them, their stories, as crazy or as heretical.
Right.
And I really take this opportunity here to thank them, because they allowed me to listen to to them and told me about issues that were involved extremely private parts of their lives. So,
well, but don't forget, Anna, you were also in Blue State, California, which is much more liberal. You know, you were up near San Francisco, and I bet your experience would have been totally different if you were trying to do this in the Bible Belt. You know, because I mean, having come from the Bible Belt, you know, or a red state that's more conservative, I mean, I get emails from listeners all the time who say, "Oh, I'm so thankful for your show because I couldn't possibly talk about any of this to anyone I know. I am surrounded by Christians." And they would, they would just write me off if they knew I was interested or believed in any of this stuff. So, and I think too, you know, I mean, I've talked to some pagans who they don't even understand that the term pagan is a derogatory term, but I understand where you're coming from too. You know, at least it exists here in the United States, even if it's only it might not be nationwide, but it does exist.
Yeah, and also people know that it exists, because in Southern Europe many people don't even know that these religious movements exist.
Interesting. And
yes.
I would have thought just the opposite. You know, I thought because Europe was so much more secular that, you know, this would be an open and easy subject in Europe.
No, it is not. It is especially difficult in traditional Catholic countries in the south of Europe.
So, when you say that, are you talking about maybe particularly Italy and Spain? I mean, does this apply in, say, France or, you know, Ireland or England, or was that not part of your focus?
Well, my focus was mainly on Italy, Spain, and recently on Portugal, where the presence of Catholicism is still very, very strong. The situation is quite different in the United Kingdom, where the pagan presence is very strong, and there have also been many scholars studying this phenomena. But also scholarship about paganism in mainland Europe is very recent, and there are a few scholars that have published extensive descriptions about this phenomenon in mainland Europe.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit now about the relationship between Mary Magdalene and the Black Madonnas. I have to tell you, when I was in Rome and I was in the Vatican and I went into one of those gift shops and I asked the little nun there about Black Madonnas, she gave me a dirty look. So I got the feeling right then and there that was not a subject that she was going to give me any information on or she thought very highly of. So I'm wondering if what you're going to tell me is of the same, in the same spirit, you know. Let's start with what's the connection between Mary Magdalene and the Black Madonnas, and then, you know, and is that a practitioner, is that with a practitioner belief versus church belief, if that makes sense?
Yeah, well, let me start with the church belief because it's easier. Basically, the church does not speak about color. For them, it is just a Madonna, and it is just an accident that the statue is black. And I mean, during my own fieldwork in Barcelona, where there is in Spain, where there is a black statue of a Christ, I really had the experience that I entered the church and I asked the people, I'm Italian, I don't know the church, where is the black Christ? And they couldn't answer, because for them this was just a statue of the Christ and they had never actually noticed that it was black. So
okay, that's a little hard to believe,
so
huh?
In, Yeah, so in the case of Black Madonnas in Italy, for instance, we have the Madonna of Loreto, and she's clearly black, but the Catholic Church does not refer to her as being black. This is not considered as something important.
So is it just because that's the color of the wood? I mean, is it? Could it be as simple as they just write it off as color of the wood? Or I know we've heard that, they say it's candle soot.
Yeah, well, there are many theories. It depends, because there are actually some wooden Madonnas, and in that case they can say that it was the candles, but there are also some Madonnas that are made of ceramic or of stone. And in this case, it is difficult. It is more difficult to explain that it has become black. And they say that sometimes they have been painted black because the artist wanted it like this. But this is not a major issue for practicing Catholics. And the contrary is true for the pilgrims I accompanied. For them, the blackness of these Madonnas pointed towards the fact that they were particularly related with darkness and with all the aspects of the sacred feminine that had been obscured by the Church. And this is also why Black Madonnas were related to Mary Magdalene, according to the pilgrims, because both represented a female aspect that had been downplayed and obscured and hidden by the Church. And there were also some theories about the fact that the Black Madonnas actually represented Mary Magdalene herself with the Son of Jesus and herself sitting on her lap. But this theory was not very widespread. Anyway, the Black Madonnas were considered as offering a particularly powerful access to the energies of Mother Earth, and it was commonly believed that these statues were to be found in places that were particularly powerful. So the churches that the pilgrims visited holding Black Madonna statues were those of Chartres and Rocamadour, and they considered these places to be powerful spots that again had been appropriated by and monopolized by the Church.
Well, and we also know at least one Black Madonna, you know, underneath the paint was an Isis statue. It's also things like that have modern pilgrims feeling like the Black Madonnas, you know, are really more closely associated maybe with Goddess, would you say?
Yes. The pilgrims also believe that the Black Madonnas might be ancient statues of the goddess that had then been reproduced or, as you say, repainted to represent the Madonna, in this case a Black Madonna. It is sure that there are striking similarities between certain statues of Isis and Christian representations of the Virgin Mary.
Yeah, I mean, I know, you know, when I would go on pilgrimage with people, you know, they would see a Black Madonna and they sort of thought of that as the goddess hidden in plain sight, you know. But you're also drawing the connection that this Black Madonna was like Mary Magdalene in the sense that she was the one you could talk to about or pray to about your, you know, a miscarriage or molestation or wounds related to sexuality or menstruation, things like that. So they're sort of parallel, I guess, you know, the Black Madonna and Mary Magdalene. Would that be correct?
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. For them, there was a clear parallelism between the Black Madonnas and Mary Magdalene in healing wounds that the Immaculate and White Virgin Mary could not address, because according to the scriptures, she had born Jesus without suffering and without having sex. So in some way, she was not the right person to talk to about issues related to sexuality.
Yeah, that's sort of like getting marriage counseling from a priest.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
you can't very well maybe relate to Mary, you know, because you don't see her as having had those same experiences. She can't relate to you, you know. Now, the importance, you call it ritual creativity. That's an interesting phrase. I guess people are getting much more creative with their ritual when it comes to Mary Magdalene. Are you referring to like the difference between the Catholic sacrifice and suffering versus the, you know, the joyous, you know, singing and dancing of the pagan or goddess pilgrims, or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I had actually never thought about it in this term, but it's true that the creativity and ritual creativity also points towards this joyous aspect of the ritual. Well, basically, when I speak about ritual creativity, I refer to the fact that these the rituals performed by the pilgrims have been newly created. They have not a long tradition, and so this is why anthropologists generally have problems taking them seriously, because they consider that a ritual is powerful if it has a long tradition and if there are strict rules to be followed, and this is not the case for the rituals the pilgrim made, because the rituals were very flexible, and they were basically created feeling how the place was and connecting with Mary Magdalene, and so when I described them, it was a challenge for me to analyze them and to have my colleagues take these rituals seriously.
But they must have realized that, you know, it's like we're blazing a new path here, you know, because, you know, goddess spirituality and reverence for the feminine divine has been suppressed for so long. It makes sense that we would need new language, we would need new rituals, we would maybe have to co-opt symbols and give them new meaning in order to speak a new language, to have a new direction, if that makes sense. You know, otherwise we're just perpetuating the same old stuff that we don't really relate to anymore.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think that in contemporary society there is an increasing need to find new rituals to make sense of classical life passages such as birth or first menstruation or even death. Death, these were events that were highly ritualized in the past, and now with the secularization and with the times that are quickly changing, these old rituals have lost most of their meaning. And so these newly created rituals are becoming more and more widespread, and they can help people to come to terms with events that also that did not exist before, or that were not as common as in previous times, as, for example, abortions or mastectomies. So I think that it is important that anthropologists take these rituals seriously and listen to the people who participate the rituals to find out how this new ritual works, because as they are new, we have still to learn what happens during
right.
the rituals and what is their effect.
Yeah, you know, because I'm thinking about as a practitioner, you know, one of the things that we learn is there's no right way and there's no wrong way. It's mostly about your good intentions, you know. So that sort of flies in the face of maybe a very structured, you know, by the book kind of, rituals that, you know, maybe the church has taught forever. And in a way, I think pagans, you know, they tend to reject the whole idea of conformity, you know, of institutionalized control. You know, they would rather have it flexible and loose because, you know, they're tired of the other, you know. It's almost as if the mm-hmm. rituals reflect their casting off of the, you know, that yoke of institutionalized religion, too, if that makes any sense.
Yes, yes, definitely. I can understand it, and this is also what I found. The problem is that very often it is believed that rituals work because they are repetitive and they are performed always in the same way throughout the history. And mm-hmm. Something that is striking for anthropologists, for instance, is that these rituals are not repeated exactly in the same way. And so the first reaction would be to say that for this reason they don't work, but this is not necessarily true. And I myself and other ritual scholars like Ronald Rimes have done extensive research into ritual creativity, and actually I'm now coordinating a special issue on ritual creativity, emotions, and the body with the Sabina Magliocco that is forthcoming in the Journal of Ritual Studies. So if you are interested in this topic,
yes.
you may want to check this out. And I think that ritual creativity is going to become more and more important, not only for pagans, but also for other people who do not recognize themselves in classical rituals and find their own way to make certain life passages sacred.
Yeah, and I mean, I can understand someone who's used to structure and someone who is used to the familiarity of the same thing happening over and over again, that at first this is a little bit strange and off-putting. But I'm thinking about a mass, for instance, you know, having been a Catholic. We did the same thing over and over again every Sunday of my life for 20 years, and it meant, you know, I have to tell you, I couldn't say to you that it was powerful or potent, you know, because of the repetition, because of the familiarity. You know, it was just sort of dead and empty. But that's just me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something to be said about, you know, liturgy. I think, you know, if you have the same liturgy, you know, that it sort of becomes a container, you know, it becomes a container for more potency. So, yeah, it would really be an interesting topic to, you know, to study and follow a bit more as we're recreating and reconstructing, you know, these new ideas, you know, of goddess spirituality. You know, I think probably the answer will be, you know, it's going to be different strokes for different folks, you know, because some things work for some people and some, and other things are going to work for other people. But, you know, I guess we'll see. You'll have to come back on the show and talk to me about it.
Yes, yes. I would be happy.
So tell me, Anna, what about, you know, how are the pilgrims giving new meaning to Christian figures and places and symbols?
Well, I in my book I show that the pilgrims tended to interpret Christian figures and symbols, turning their meaning upside down. And actually, this is also something that was a bit upsetting my colleagues, because it was not that they were kind of creating totally new rituals. They were using figures, Christian figures and Christian sites. So in some way, this was perceived as being inappropriate.
Blasphemy. And, blasphemy. You know, why don't you give, what can you give some examples?
Yeah, well, for instance, Christianity venerates God the Father in the sky, and the pilgrims venerated Mother Earth, who is female and located below. Or, for instance, Christianity describes menstrual blood as related to Eve's curse and the original sin, and the pilgrims celebrate the sacredness of menstruation. And some of the female pilgrims I accompanied also offered their menstrual blood to Mother Earth, I mentioned this before, and celebrated a sort of inverse Eucharist. Instead of celebrating Jesus' blood, they celebrated the sacredness of menstruation. And the only they celebrated the fact that menstrual blood is the only blood that flows without anybody being wounded.
Right.
Whereas in the case of Jesus, it is the blood of Jesus who is wounded and actually killed.
Interesting.
So this was an important inversion.
Mm. Well, and really what it points to is, you know, the pilgrims are honoring nature. You know, the pilgrims are honoring what is, you know, I mean, it's Christianity that's sort of turned everything on its head and had us, you know, sort of marginalize or make taboo, you know, what is natural, you know, the natural life cycles, you know, whether it be sexuality or menstruation or, you know, or any of these things. You know, it's like anything of the woman is unclean and you know it not a good thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. This is very similar to how pilgrims explained these ritual inversions to me, I think it is. Also, we can see this inversion in the case of the Black Madonna. Now we have this white and immaculate Virgin Mary, and on the other side, on the opposite side, this inversion of the Black Madonna that is related to the earth and not to heaven.
Right, right, absolutely, the chthonic aspects of goddess. Well, Anna, Matthew hasn't shown up on the switchboard yet. So we have a little bit more time. Is there anything else you want to share with listeners about your thesis? I'm curious if you've won over any of your colleagues now. Do we have any converts in their ranks, or do you know they still have trouble, you know, sort of accepting this reconstruction or this new spirituality?
Well, I think that things have changed considerably during these 10 years, the last 10 years. And so now the situation is different. Also, at that time I was a PhD student, and now I am a researcher, and I have published several books, so it is easier. But I think that also several scholars have now published books also, not only about paganism, but also about contemporary spirituality and about ritual creativity. And so it is easier to speak about this kind of things now. And then things have changed considerably. And this is, but I think that there is still much to be done. Basically, the most important thing for me when writing, when preparing my dissertation and my book, was to write in a sensitive and respectful way about these pilgrimages. And I hope that I have managed to do that, and that the pilgrims are are satisfied with the result. I am still in touch with many of them, and I have sent them a copy of the book. And I'm relieved to see that they are not too critical with my work, because of course it's very difficult. I mean, I really did my best. I also had to translate their life stories and all their spiritual experiences from Spanish and Italian and Catalan to English. So in the translation process, maybe something has been lost, or it was really challenging. And I really feel relieved that so far nobody has harshly criticized me.
Well, that's great. I'm glad it's been positive. Is there anything else you'd like to maybe tell us? That you've discovered in this journey that we haven't talked about yet.
Well, I think that we have pretty much covered all the points regarding my book, and those listening to this program are interested, they can find more information on my webpage, that is basically my name, and www.annafedele.com. And also they can post comments if they want. And for me, it is important that my work stays in connection with what is going on within the pagan community now. So I will be happy to receive feedback and to discuss my research with those following your program. And thank you very much for having me and for allowing me to discuss all this. I hope what I said made sense, because in the middle of the night it was not so easy.
Oh, you know what? You did an excellent job. Thank you so very much, Anna. You were great. Understood you perfectly, and it was a great interview. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and well, maybe we will talk on another occasion as well.
Yes, absolutely. Please, get in touch if there's another topic you'd like to share with listeners. Definitely keep my contact information.
Okay, so have a nice rest of the show, and I will go to sleep now.
Okay, go to sleep. Good night,
yeah.
And thank you. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye. Well, listeners, I see Matthew Fox has just popped up on the switchboard here, and we're going to get to him in just a minute. I want to just let you know that we are crossing the threshold into the second part of the show here. And it is my great pleasure to have returning with us Matthew Fox. Matthew's a former Catholic priest who was first stopped from teaching liberation theology and creation spirituality by a former pope when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, then expelled from the Dominican order to which he belonged for 34 years. He's an Episcopal priest now and the author of over two dozen books, most recently The Pope's War, Why Ratzinger Secret Crusade Has Imperiled the Church and How It Can Be Saved, and his latest book, Hildegard of Bingen, A Saint for Our Times, Unleashing Her Power in the 21st Century. Welcome, Matthew, back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Karen. I've been on the line for 20 minutes. It's been very frustrating.
Really?
And, yes. And
you had trouble connecting?
Obviously.
Yeah. Well, you know what?
I tried to connect through another phone, and then I called my administrator, and he said, well, it was another different phone number, and it was just very complicated. But
I'm so sorry.
I'm glad to finally hear you, but I'm not late. I was on the phone at
5:07,
and I heard the very interesting interview you just finished.
I didn't feel like you were late. You were right about on time, and I'm so sorry you had trouble. I will, afterwards you can tell me more about it, and I will report it to the people over at Blog Talk, because occasionally they do have a technical glitch, but I'm glad you're here now. And, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to have you back is, I watched and read some of the interviews you were doing around the time our new Pope Francis had been selected, with the exception of maybe the interview with Amy Goodman. I sort of got the distinct impression you had a lot more to say, but maybe the media really wasn't willing to let you say it. You know, maybe you were kind of on a short leash. Was my intuition right there?
Well, part of the short leash is, of course, time. Like you say, they prefer sound bites or very short exchanges to more reflective ones. But so I'm glad to be on your program and have a chance to talk in a little more depth.
Yes, absolutely. That's one of the things I think my listeners appreciate about this. You know, we can sort of delve into a subject and we don't talk in sound bites. So your book, The Pope's War, that's really the one where you get into how the Vatican and the CIA were, and I think even Ronald Reagan, were conspiring to break liberation theology in Latin America, correct?
Yes, definitely, yeah. And I have that footnoted.
Well, let me ask you first, just in case, you know, my listeners who don't know a lot about liberation theology, can you start with a definition of what is liberation theology and why would they be so afraid of it that they would want to quash it?
Well, liberation theology grew up after the Second Vatican Council in South America, and it was a response to the oppression there of dictators and military juntas, and it was about putting justice first and about a preferential option for the poor, and there were a lot of poor there in the late 60s, early 70s. Of course, there still are, and there are a lot of poor in our country too, but it was a tremendously positive movement because it reinvented the liturgy, for one thing. It got people to meet in circles to talk about their experience of fighting for justice and the reading and experience of the Gospels. So it was in many ways a very democratic movement, moving from kind of a hierarchical approach to worship to a more circular one. And this threatened a lot of people, but you had tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, really, of Christians, especially Catholics in South America, really responding to the call for justice. And then, of course, you had notable figures like Oscar Romero, who was murdered by the military for standing on the side of the poor while he was actually saying Mass. He was assassinated. And you had Cardinal Arns in Brazil standing up to the military junta, and Bishop Casidaliga in the Amazon, who was standing up on behalf of the indigenous people there, but also the rainforest. And he was actually silenced by the Vatican. A bishop being silenced by the Vatican is rather rare. And you had, of course, the election of Arlande in Peru, and he was overthrown. So with the help, of course, of the CIA, and Kissinger and Nixon did that. Kissinger and Nixon also overthrew the government in Argentina and replaced it with that junta that killed probably 30,000 people, tortured them and killed them. And then the American gunboats protected the military in Brazil. When the military were running things in Brazil, the American gunboats were right off the shores there, protecting them, if you will. So,
liberation,
you know, the American media doesn't tell us. what our government has been doing very much in South America. But the Catholic Church, to its credit, really grew up overnight almost in installing gospel values of justice. And but the strategy of the CIA was to say, oh, this isn't Christianity, this is Marxism. And that was their line. And
sounds like Fox News.
Well, that's right. And the truth is that 2 months after Reagan took office as president for the first time, there was a gathering of the National Security Council in Santa Fe to discuss one question: how can we destroy liberation theology in South America? And,
so liberation theology would have brought on more critical thinking, would have brought on more liberation for the people. They wouldn't have been sheeple, so easily to dominate, and that's what was so threatening?
That's right. That's right. And it was threatening to Wall Street, very much so, because it was about developing economic systems that do not just profit a few, that don't just profit the rich and the landowners. And in South America, a lot of these countries were really being run by a very small number of families who dominated the economic and agricultural commerce and so forth. So they were being challenged at the time.
So
and,
it's another 99%. Another 99% versus
that's
the
right.
1%.
That's right. A lot of it was that exactly.
Yeah. And so they wanted to basically keep the people in poverty and ignorance and slave wages, and the religion would have helped lift them out of that. But unfortunately, well, and it's sad, really, because when you think about ideally, you know, Christianity is supposed to be about the teachings of Jesus, but it's sort of it has turned out not to be about that.
Well, at times it has, you know, at times it certainly has, and that was one such time. Another time was, of course, the civil rights movement in America. I mean, that grew out of the churches, the black churches, especially. But many other churches got on board in the synagogue. Of course, Rabbi Heschel and other Jewish, progressive Jewish thinkers got on board with the civil rights movement. So that also, you know, I think was a very authentic expression of the Gospels. But, yeah,
so, Matthew, where are these voices now? You know, why are there not more religious leaders speaking out against capitalism, greed, exploitation? You know, what's happened?
Well, I point out in my book on the papacy of the last 35 years called The Pope's War that really there was this link up between the right-wing elements of the American government and the papacy for 35 years, and that's why they attacked the priests and the sisters and the lay people who were leading in this regard. But this new pope from Argentina, Pope Francis, I think it's very possible that he is shifting gears. He's had some very strong things to say lately about the system itself, that he's been very critical of the slave labor and so forth, and I think that he's going to be much more outspoken than the others were. But a lot of the proof of the pudding also is in the people that they appoint from Rome as bishops and cardinals and so forth. So they've been appointing very, very far right-wing people such as Opus Dei, and I have a whole chapter in that book on Opus Dei, and it's a very fascist movement, and it grew out of fascist Spain. And so they've been appointing cardinals and bishops head over heels from that organization, which is really quite scary.
Well, you know, I think most people will recognize Opus Dei from the Da Vinci Code. Was that an accurate representation, or was that just way off the mark?
It's not way off the mark. You know, a lot of that is accurate. In some ways, it's even more sinister than that, because they have embedded themselves in the American media and in finance, especially in Europe. And even I think the Supreme Court has its share, and certainly the CIA had its share of Opus Dei people. So you know, so many people are naive, really. One person who read, who's a very knowledgeable man in the field of ecumenism, religious ecumenism, he wrote my book, read my book, The Pope's War, and he said, you know, this book isn't just about the Pope. This is about the few number of people who are running the world, who are making all the decisions for the rest of us, that 1% that you were talking about,
mm-hmm.
and how they interact, because I think the papacy has been used. It's interesting, for example, that the previous pope, near the end of his time, they wanted to appoint a new PR person for the papacy, give it a better spin. And who did they go to? They went to Fox News, and they hired a fellow from Fox News who is Opus Dei. And I guess people think that's normal, but it's just ordinary that you would have a member of that organization that would be out of the closet, because usually they used to be very secretive, Opus Dei, but now they're more out of the closet because they've been given so much wind in their sails by the last two papacies.
Wow. Well, I did see the article about Pope Francis criticizing the global cult of money. Is it too soon to tell if, you know, it's just all smoke and mirrors, or if, you know, there might actually be some hope on the horizon?
I think it's possible there could be some hope on the horizon. I'm just completing now a public letter to Pope Francis that will be published as an electronic book within a few weeks, I think. And so I've delved into him quite deeply. I think his choice of the name Francis is very telling and is kind of risky. No one else has used that name ever with the papacy, for good reason. So I tell him, you know, we're going to be watching. We're going to hold his feet to the fire. Obviously, Francis stood for three very important things. One is, of course, standing with the poor. But secondly, he stands for gender justice, because he was extremely sensitive to the whole masculine-feminine yin-yang balance that's present in his poetry, for example. And then thirdly, he, of course, stands for ecology and for our relationship to nature. So I think all these areas
dangerous
are areas
subjects.
That Pope Francis, they're very pertinent today, and I think he will be judged on them, and I presume he knows that. So you're right, he has been speaking quite forcefully about the global cult of money and about the an economic system that is only benefiting a few. He's been quite outspoken.
I'm sorry. Aside from the money thing about the gender justice, I mean, he just supported the Vatican's position, though, on the nuns, you know, about the radical feminism that the nuns are practicing. So that made me think, oh, you know what, it's just going to be more of the same.
That will be another test. But I don't think, from what I've seen, that all that is third hand. I mean, what I've read is that, you know, some person in one of those bureaucracies in the Curia said that the Pope says it'll be the same thing. But let's wait and see what he actually does.
So that wasn't official then?
I don't think it was official, no. I've not seen it officially. I don't see it. I have not seen it come from his mouth. In fact, what I have seen is that there's a big division within the Curia, within the Vatican, about this subject, and that he appointed a second person in charge of the religious who is open, and actually got up and made a speech just last week saying that he was not even consulted about this movement to silence the women, nuns, and all that. And then a big fight broke out, and a guy on the other side said, oh, but you were, and so forth, and they said, no, I wasn't. So anyway, there's infighting going on, which I guess is pretty typical when bureaucracies have a new leader.
And especially if I can understand that there would be fighting if he is going to take a different position, more like Francis, as you said. And
right.
Well, has he said anything about, for instance, climate change? You know, if Francis was about environmentalism, or he hasn't really addressed that yet either.
I think he has. He did an interesting book the Pope did is a dialogue with a rabbi who's also a PhD in science. And it's quite a good book. One thing I appreciate, because it shows that he's open, he's ecumenical. And he is. And this rabbi really vouches for him and says he was, as archbishop in Argentina, that he was very favorable and open to the Jewish community. And just to see these two people dialoguing is a breath of fresh air, I think, especially after the last pope who said things like Protestants weren't churches and so forth. I think he does have some environmental awareness. For one thing, in Argentina today, the glaciers are melting all over the place, and of course they're very near the Antarctic, and they know how the Antarctic is breaking up into icebergs and floating away and so forth. So I can't imagine that he would be oblivious of the climate change that's going on today. Not at all.
Well, are you? I mean, I feel free to correct me, because I want to get it right. I read that, you know, the cardinals were basically stacked. You know, the Vatican. I mean, it was stacked with cardinals that were of the Ratzinger ilk. So, if that's true, are you surprised that Francis was picked as pope, because he doesn't stand for? You know, if he does come through with all of these things, he's not perpetuating, you know, their beliefs or agenda. I mean, do you think that's their fear that the church needs to change, or am I putting too much into this?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right that all the cardinals who are voting were appointed by Ratzinger directly as pope, or indirectly when he was the right-hand man to the previous pope, John Paul II. So it was absolutely stacked against any progressive thinkers, because there aren't any. They've been weeded out, and one of the points I make in my book on the pope is I have a list at the back of 105 theologians who have been hounded and harassed and excommunicated, some of them, and expelled. I was just one of those. There are 105 all over the world. So the last two papacies, the previous two papacies, absolutely were dumbing down the church. They wanted yes men and nothing else. And that's why you had this big pedophile scandal, because they didn't have intelligent men and men of conscience making decisions. They just had yes men. So there's no question that it was stacked against any kind of progressive thinking. But it is possible that this fellow kind of snuck in. And the truth is that there were cardinals who saw the terrible scandals going on in the Curia and were upset at how many of the Curia were named cardinals under Ratzinger. In December a year ago, he created a whole slew of secretaries in the Curia, made them cardinals, so it became even more unbalanced. But there were some, I think cardinals, especially from the Third World, who were pretty fed up with the way things are running in Rome. So I think, like I say, it's we have to wait and see. But I think there's some hope here. But let me say this unequivocally. The church renewal does not happen at the top. It's going to happen at the grassroots. It's what people are doing. A lot of people today are simply moving ahead. They're starting their own communities, small communities. Many women are getting themselves ordained and starting their own communities. And I think that's, and of course, the whole liberation theology movement is about base communities. So I think this is the future. And in fact, this new pope has actually spoken about that before he was pope. He said he very much endorsed the idea of small communities. So I think that's really the place to look, rather than at the top. Now, at the top, the pope has done some gestures, like he refuses to move into the palace at the Vatican. I think that's a good gesture. Gestures are nice, but the rubber hits the road, as you say, with the decisions he'll make about women and about other issues that are
what he does with the pedophile priests and all the money scandals and everything
else.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the former Pope before we go on to the other stuff. Was there a real reason why he stepped down? I mean, do you believe the health issue, or is that, do you think that was sort of just a cover story?
Well, I did hear from a reliable journalistic source that three cardinals did a report on the scandals in the Curia, and they gave it to him, and he resigned 4 hours later, and he put it in his safe and said the next pope has to deal with this. And so I think that, you know, he's 84, and I think he was pretty aware that he was ineffective, that things were just running crazy. The Curia was a kind of like a machine in itself, running its own show. But the truth is that Cardinal Ratzinger spent his adult life trying to return the church to the 17th century. And he just turned the clock back on everything. And that's why I maintain in my book on those two popes, John Paul II and himself, Ratzinger, that that they were in schism because they turned their back on the Vatican Council, and the Vatican Council, a council trumps a pope in the Catholic tradition, not the other way around. So I think you could really say that every cardinal and bishop appointed the last 40 years has been in schism. So what that really means is, hey, Catholics are free to go the direction they need to go and to follow the principles of the gospel and of Vatican II, and the institutional church is simply way behind and way off track. Now, can new pope bring it back? Well, we'll see.
Sounds not unlike our politicians who vote with the corporations rather than what the majority of people want.
Well, there you go, yeah.
And I think I read you said that you think Ratzinger will be remembered for bringing back the Inquisition.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know many of my listeners will know about Father Roy Bourgeois, most recently, mm-hmm. you know, excommunicated. But, you know, what might come as a surprise to them, Matthew, especially some of my younger listeners, is part of the reason that you were, I hate that word, excommunicated, but because you considered, is it true you considered yourself a feminist theologian called God Mother and didn't have a problem with Native Americans and pagan rituals?
Well, that is the list of complaints that Cardinal Ratzinger made against me and my theology. Number one, that I was a feminist theologian. Number two, that I call God Mother. Number three, that I call God Child. I don't know what he does on Christmas. Number four, that I prefer Original Blessing to Original Sin, because that was the title of one of my books, Original Blessing. And yes, he says I work too closely with Native Americans. I really don't know what that means. And I don't condemn homosexuals. So, yeah, those are his complaints against my work. And so I'm just one of those 105 theologians that he denounced and tried to spread fear to other theologians to kind of shut up and get in line. That was all part of the strategy there. And you have to understand that this is not Ratzinger working alone. He had complete carte blanche from Pope John Paul II. It's like Ratzinger was the bad cop, John Paul II was a good cop, but the truth is a good cop gave Ratzinger complete blank check to do all these things. So history will wrap Pope John Paul II into all this as well. He brought the Inquisition back with the help of Cardinal Ratzinger.
So Matthew, what are your views on the sacred feminine? I mean, you know, can you elaborate a little bit on that? You know, where does it belong, you believe, in within spirituality or Christianity?
Well, it's an absolute essential a dimension of renewal of our species and of all our institutions to bring the divine feminine back. Mm-hmm. Without the divine feminine, for example, in education, what you have is knowledge factories. You don't have wisdom schools. You don't have wisdom, you just have knowledge. And that's one reason that education is in such a crisis today. So it cuts across the board that we any human, both individual and our cultural institutions, have to find a yin-yang balance that's healthy. And part of that healthiness, of course, I wrote a book 2 years ago called The Hidden Spirituality of Men, 10 Metaphors to Awaken the Sacred Masculine. So part of the health, too, is we have to reinvent the masculine, that it incorporate a healthy instead of a toxic masculinity. And this is not just for men, but for women as well.
So what would that be for men? What's the new archetype, or, you know, how do men have to change?
I throw 10 archetypes in that book, like Father Sky, the green man, the blue man, hunter-gatherer, spiritual warrior, father, the father archetype, the grandfather, the elder, and so forth. All those are very, very rich archetypes that can stir up the passion and the healthy power of men. Whereas what we have running on toxic masculinity is about I win, you lose. It's really about rewarding the reptilian brain. And it's about conquering, vanquishing instead of partnering.
Yeah, domination. Domination rather than...
It's about domination, yeah. And it's not about joy. It's not about celebration. You know, Marija Gimbutas, the feminist archaeologist, says the essence of the goddess civilization was the celebration of life. Well, that would be a nice way to start civilization over, wouldn't it?
It would
mean we'd reinvent education and politics and economics and religion.
It would change the world.
It would change the world. Now, my most recent book that you alluded to, the one on Hildegard, is exciting in this regard because she was definitely bringing the divine feminine back and in the 12th century. And I think it's one of the greatest ironies of all is that it was Cardinal Ratzinger, Pope Benedict XVI, before he quit, one of the last things he did was canonize Hildegard, both a saint and a doctor of the church. And yet she is a Trojan horse because she is incarnating, really, the divine feminine. For example, around creativity, she says there is wisdom in all creative works, and she was a first-class musician, composer, lyricist. She wrote the first opera ever in the West. It's 300 years older than any other opera. She was a healer, working with herbs and even crystals and animals. She had a shamanistic dimension to her. She was a scientist. She wrote over 10 books. So she's just an amazingly Renaissance woman. But she also, one of her biggest themes was the divine feminine, and is present in so much of her imagery. For example, she calls Mary the ground of all being. Well, that's a stunning statement. That really makes Mary a goddess.
Right,
but the ground
right.
of all being. I mean, other mystics call God the ground of all being. She calls Mary the ground of all being. It's very profound.
Well, doesn't it surprise you that Ratzinger would have, you said canonized her?
Both canonized her and made her a doctor of the church. And there have only been three other women who've been named doctor of the church. About 30 men, but three women, so she's the fourth.
Well, it
so,
seems like a conflict of interest for him.
Well, it's an irony. See, I don't think he knew what he was doing. I don't think he read Hildegard that closely, but he was German, and Hildegard was German, and I think that he kind of did it more out of a pious streak, because the Germans have often, for centuries, been calling her a saint, so he kind of, in effect, said, well, let's make this thing official. But that's why I call her a Trojan horse. The last chapter of my book on Hildegard is she a Trojan horse who's been brought into not only the patriarchal Vatican, but into the patriarchy of society. In her day, she wrote letters to the Pope, to the Emperor, to kings, telling them they were out of touch with Lady Justice, and they should change their ways and all the rest. Oh, she has some very strong things to
and
say.
She lived, and she lived. If she lived through it, they didn't find a way to burn her at the stake.
That book
is going to be out in October, isn't it, Matthew?
No, that book is out.
It's out now.
The Hildegard book.
Yeah,
it came out last October. Mm-hmm.
Oh, last October.
Hildegard
okay.
is being in Saint for our times. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Came out this past fall. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, it sounds like that would be a really interesting book, and I like your description. You know, she's kind of a Trojan horse.
This
might be a kind of a silly question, but I've read that that you've said the Vatican, the Taliban, extremist Christians, they all share in common their fear of the divine feminine and equal rights for women. You know, forgive me if this is just a crazy question, but really, what is so, you know, what has them so afraid? Is it simply not wanting to share power? I mean, can it be that simple?
No, I think there's more to it than that. I think it's the fear of the goddess Chaos, because in the ancient times, in goddess times, Chaos was represented as a goddess. So she was integrated into culture. And, of course, Chaos is part of creativity. And I think it's ultimately it's a fear of creativity and a fear of losing control. So when patriarchy took over, the myths changed, and Marduk then killed Tiamat. So there was like this permission for the masculine to lord over, dominate, and even murder the feminine. But it really, I think what's really happening unconsciously, if you will, was a fear of the goddess Chaos. So if you look at all these excessive patriarchal institutions like the Taliban and the Vatican and Pat Robertson, they all want to lock the women up, you see, because women represent creativity and chaos. And of course, science was this way too until the 1960s when chaos theory emerged. And one of the founders of chaos theory, a mathematician here at the University of Santa Cruz, Ralph Abram, wrote a brilliant book called Chaos, Eros, and Gaia. And in it, he talks about how this shift happened from the goddess times to male-dominated times, and how originally religion, felt they were in charge of controlling the women, but in the 17th century, science took over and said, hey, we're the orthodox ones, we'll handle this. Until the 1960s, when chaos theory showed, whoops, there's chaos in all the natural systems of the world, including the weather systems and the imperfect ellipses of a planet and all this, and chaos is absolutely essential for creativity. So I think that that's when things began to shift. Science even got on board then. So I think that's what's really behind fundamentalism. It's a compulsion to control the feminine insofar as the feminine represents chaos and creativity.
Okay, well, I understand all that, and I know chaos is, metaphorically a scary thing. But what do they think that would actually manifest into in literal terms? I mean, you know, we're going to lock up all the men and, you know, suddenly dominate the world. I mean, what do they think would really happen other than they might have to, you know, pay women equal pay and, you know, we wouldn't do 80% of the work with 20% of the assets? I mean, does it come down to the money?
Well, I pardon me for laughing, but I love your question because you have to understand most of this is unconscious. So they're afraid of their own shadow. In fact, Hildegard writes that. She sends a letter to the Pope and she says, you're surrounded by people, meaning the Curia, who are like hens who cackle at night and scare themselves while they're cackling at night. So I think that's what you have going on there. You have the idea of, right, it's the imagination running wild. And that's why your question makes me laugh, because you're asking that they please nail this down, tell us what it is they're really afraid of. But, you know, fear is a lot of it dwells in the unconscious, and that's why I laugh, because they can't name it, you know.
And when
you do start naming it, it's too ridiculous, and you start to name it. You know, they think the men are going to be locked up by the women, and they'll throw the keys away, et cetera, et cetera.
Gee,
so
we might have men as sex slaves or something.
What's that?
We might have used men as sex slaves or something, you know.
God forbid.
Well, you're dealing with
the shadow here. You're dealing with the shadow, and unfortunately, it's not a laughing matter, of course.
Right.
It is about power, and it translates itself that way. But it maybe finally we're beginning to put it above table so we can laugh at it, such as as you and I are doing right now, but also to see it for what it is. It is ridiculous. It's almost laughable.
Well, not only is it ridiculous, it's unjust, you know.
Well,
and how can you be taken seriously in religion if you perpetuate injustice, you know?
Well, exactly. And the truth is that one deep dimension to Jesus that made him stand out as a revolutionary was his attitude toward women.
Right.
That he broke taboo with both the Jewish laws of his time and with the Roman laws of his time. And the first generation of Christians, women were definitely leaders and were playing many leadership roles. And Paul even talks about that, how he had these women working with him, not under him, but with
mm-hmm.
him.
Yeah.
But it was the second generation where the men started taking over, and then third generation more, et cetera, et cetera. And then they wrapped it up in something called all male priesthood.
Well, and, you know, going back to what you were saying before about the fear, you know, the fear of the chaos, you remind me, I think it's George Lakoff, maybe, who writes about the conservatives are much more fear-based because of the, I think, the amygdala in the brain. So I think, you know, there's scientific proof for the fear-based conservative, too. So, you know, maybe that's part of this as well, you know. They're working against science as well as this shadow stuff.
Well, that's very interesting. And again, this is one wonderful thing about Hildegard. There's nothing anti-science or anti-intellectual about her. She says all science comes from God.
Mm.
And Thomas Aquinas, who came a generation after, also said, a mistake about creation was also a mistake about God. So we need to follow science. We need scientists to tell us, hey, what is creation really like? So
right.
that we're not just living in our imaginations and our making up boogeymen and going to war about that.
So does that mean you see where maybe creationism and the ideas of evolution can exist in parallel?
Well, not creationism, because creationism is a very narrow version of the history of the universe, but definitely evolution, and of course this is what Teilhard de Chardin was all about. But so is Thomas Berry, kind of a disciple of Teilhard. So he's done wonderful work, and Brian Swim on the new universe story and how it does contain elements of a very healthy spiritual consciousness
alongside the science.
Alongside the science, absolutely,
right.
Because it
fills
us with awe and wonder. And Einstein talked about that too. That he said that mystery and awe and wonder is what all science is about. And he said we're given two brains. One should serve the intellectual brain should serve the intuitive brain, and of course, the intuitive brain is the mystical brain. It's the brain of values and feeling. He says the intellect does not give us values.
Right.
The intellect gives us methods, but the intuition gives us values. But he said in our culture, we've ignored the intuitive brain, and everything is about the rational. This is Einstein. No one can accuse him of being anti-intellectual, but he's nailed it. I think that our educational system, for example, leaves out the awe and the wonder, and therefore the kids are bored.
Yeah, well, and those are the, you know, what's representative of the feminine too. You know, the creative, the intuitive. That's
absolutely.
sort of marginalized as being unimportant. Well, Matthew, we have probably about 5 minutes left. I wanted to ask you. You mentioned Maria Gimbutas a few minutes ago, and I was glad to hear you actually mention her because so many people give her a bad rap. Even though, I mean, Joseph Campbell, who I know a lot of mainstream people know about, called her work the Rosetta Stone. Do you have other goddess scholars or favorite feminist writers?
Oh, definitely. Dorothy Sola, I have a lot of respect for. She was a German liberation theologian who taught at Union in New York for 10 years. And she did wonderful work on the mystics and on Meister Eckhart. And she says that really mysticism is the real meaning of religion. And her definition of mysticism, and she says she gets it from Paul, is that you cannot fall out of the love of God. You cannot fall out of the love of God. So there's a kind of trust and certainty there. So she says that mysticism is the real deconstruction of hierarchy and of masculine consciousness to build this more healthy yin-yang balance of healthy masculine and healthy feminine. So I think a lot of her. Of course, Clarissa Pinkola Estes, I have a chapter in my Hildegard book about Hildegard meeting Dorothy Sola, another one on Hildegard meeting Clarissa Pinkola Estes. I think her book, Women Running with the Wolves, is a classic from the 20th century.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah. I've interviewed her here.
Oh, yeah, great. Yeah, she's wonderful. No, I have so many women. I've been blessed with so many teachers. And then, of course, historically, of course, Hildegard, but there's also Mechtilde Magdeburg. Juliana Norwich is stunning, absolutely stunning, way ahead of her time. Her books
are published. Oh, yeah, I'm going to have Paul, I think McComb is going to be on talking about Julian of Norwich in a few weeks.
Good. Yeah. She's exceptional. And we've been blessed, of course, because of the birth of rebirth of women's scholarship in the last 40 years, that so many women have stepped up. Lisbeth Fiorenzo, who teaches scripture at Harvard, is excellent. And one thing about women scholars and theologians is that they tend to ask a little different questions than men have been asking. Therefore, it's just so much more interesting. I knew Mary Daly when she first wrote her book, Beyond God the Father, back in the early 70s. It was a classic work that really broke things wide open. And I was teaching in a women's college, Barrow College, in north of Chicago. And so I called her on the phone. I'd never met her, but I loved her book so much. I called her on the phone and I said, I want to thank you for your book, Beyond God the Father. I said, I think your book makes Karl Marx look like a pansy. There was a very long silence. And then she said, thank you very much. And after that, I did meet her. I brought her out to lecture at our school. And having met her, I realized that was the perfect thing to say to Mary Daly.
So, Matthew,
Rosemary Ruther also taught with us a lot over the years.
Okay. As we're running short on time here, words of wisdom would you give to listeners who, hope to usher in a new world? What can they do? What shouldn't they do? What advice do you have?
Okay, and let me put one more name out there. Of course,
sure.
Mary Oliver, I think she's a real mystic in our time, wonderful at it. I think the key is to develop your mystical and prophetic faculties. The prophetic side is saying no, and the mystical side is saying yes. The mystic is the lover, and the prophet is the warrior. And we all need that energy, that until you develop both of those, you're not adult in your spirituality, I think. Some people, I think, have been misled to think that spirituality is just about spiritual experiences. No, it's also about service. It's also about rattling cages and interfering. So Rabbi Heschel defines a prophet as one who interferes.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this passion to put your love to practice, and to practice, and that's where justice and compassion come in. So I think that it's very possible, because I think we're all born with this as mystics and prophets, to be lovers and of the world, and also prophets to stand up and be counted. And I think that's the real test of healthy spirituality.
To be a loving spiritual activist.
There you go, yeah.
I think that's what you just said.
Oh, that's good, a contemplative activist.
Sometimes
yeah,
it's hard
activist.
To be a loving spiritual activist.
Well, let me put in a little plug here for a group. I'm working with Andrew Harvey on something called the Christ Path Seminar now, where we're trying to reinvent Christianity on these principles of the cosmic Christ, the mystical side, and the prophetic side, sacred activism. So we're doing our next event in Pittsburgh in June, but it's also live streaming, so people can participate in person or they can participate by live streaming. And the whole idea is to kind of ratchet up and set a fire to the Western tradition, because there is so much in Christianity that is useful today, but there's also a huge burden of extra stuff that is weighing things down unnecessarily.
So, Matthew, how if someone wants to follow you, learn more about your books and the work you're doing, what's the website?
Well, the website is simply matthewfox.org, or they could go to this thing called Christ Path Seminar, which is that project I'm doing with Andrew Harvey and others. We have a guest lecturer each time. Joanna Macy was our first lecturer. And so they could find out a lot more of the work with matthewfox.org.
Okay. Well, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming back. And
thank you.
And I hope you'll be back again.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the work you're doing. It's very important to have journalists who are asking these kinds of questions. And
okay. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Appreciate your work
Bye.
Out there. Good night. Well, I hope you've enjoyed those two interviews. I know I sure did, and we only have a couple minutes here, so I would like to just let you know that who we have coming up on the show next week. Next Thursday, not Wednesday, Rabbi Wayne Dosick will be with us. He's the author of the book, The Real Name of God, Embracing the Full Essence of the Divine, followed by Christopher Penzack, who we have not heard from in a while, but he'll be returning and chatting about the Mighty Dead, his book on the enlightened ancestors, ascended masters, saints, and bodhisattvas. Also, I want to let you know, if you're in Southern California, we have coming up on the 15th of June the Summer Solstice Fair at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Long Beach. It's it's the Long Beach Woman Spirit Fair, put on by Long Beach Woman Spirit and the Temple of Isis in Los Angeles. If you would like more information about that, you can go to longbeachwomanspirit.org. But that's June 15th from 10 to 4 at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Long Beach. I will be there. I will have a table, and I hope you will come by and say hello. Also, please save the date. The Goddess Spirit Rising Conference is in Malibu, California, September 6th, 7th, and 8th. For more on that, go to goddessspiritrising.com. And save the date, too, October 6th. I know it's a long ways off, but put it in your calendar. Save the date, Pagan Pride Day at Rainbow Lagoon Park in Long Beach, Sunday, October 6th. So I want to thank you, listeners, for being with me tonight. I think it was a wonderful show. I hope you enjoyed it. I'd also like to thank the organizers of World Fest for putting together a wonderful alternative lifestyle, green, vegan, conscious-raising event this past Sunday, and for inviting me to be on their panel where I gave my talk, Go Goddess, Values of the Sacred Feminine for a Sustainable Future. And I've been asking for the last couple weeks for a favor of listeners, but I'll keep asking again until I've gotten the word out. I am really trying to sell out of my remaining copies of Sacred Places of Goddess. So if you're thinking about a gift for yourself, please go to my website, KarenTate.com, and check out the books there. I actually sell them cheaper than you can get them new online. So just remember the motto of our show, by Gandhi: first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. So we'll close tonight's show with Abigail Spinner McBride's, hang on a second, I lost it here, Abigail Spinner McBride, Pass Through the Portal.
At this time of Samhain, when the veils between the worlds are thin, through the power of one mind, with the pure love of one heart, we open a portal to the other side. We peel back the veil and we call to those of our ancestors and beloved dead who would like to experience this time of magic with us. We invite them to be fully present in this sacred space, to see through our eyes, to move through our bodies, to speak through our words, and to dance in this space with us, until we close our circle, when they will return across the Great Divide. We welcome the ancestors. Blessed be. Pass through the portal, go through the gate, enter and be reborn. Pass through the portal, go through the gate, enter and be reborn. Pass through the portal.